Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
As always, I want to thank the Pardes Institute, that's pardas.org.il, for helping to make this class happen. Hi, everybody. Good morning. This is class three, right? So finally, we're going to get to Mendelssohn, even though I said that was where we were going to start. But always remember that the backstory is usually more than the story itself. So in the big picture, what I want to do today is I want to talk a little bit more specifically about what was the Enlightenment. Obviously, it's not a sort of graduate course in European history, so we're going to cram it all into about 15 minutes. And I'm going to give a heavy emphasis on why the Jews care about what the Enlightenment was. But it's an important sort of piece of general knowledge. We'll start there, and then really I want to take most of the rest of the class to speak about the personality of Moses Mendelssohn. Who there's so much, you know, I mentioned this idea of history and then the history of reception, right? That there's history as it happened, and even as it's taught with the effort to portray what happened. But then there's the fact that historical events mean something to each generation. So as we'll see, just to give you a sense, Moses Mendelssohn, I'm sure somewhere here, here it is, beautiful. I even put it in bold, Mendelssohn eulogies. You know, just to give you a sense of what I mean, is that Yitzhak Eichel, who was one of the sort of intellectual inheritors of Mendelssohn in what's called the Berlin Enlightenment, we'll talk about it, when he eulogized Moses Mendelssohn, he called him precious in his generation, unique amongst his people. You know, that sounds really good, right? But when Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger, who was a student of the Chatam Sofer, spoke about him, he was the evil Moses of Dessau, leader of the rebels, who had the cunning of a snake and begun bringing the foreign harlot amongst the Jews to make them go whoring after false gods. Lest you think that rabbis are afraid of, sort of like spicy language. No, but meaning that Mendelssohn represents far more than the actual events of his life. Because as each generation tries to find itself in relationship to his past, we have a tendency to create a persona out of a person. Spinoza is another classic example. All right, and Spinoza, I don't know if you know, I had a really big sort of intellectual rebirth. Anybody know when? Zionism. Sure, and we'll speak a little bit actually as we get to the differences between Mendelssohn and Spinoza, perhaps about why that was. So we're going to do, we'll talk a little bit about Enlightenment, we'll tell the story of Moses Mendelssohn, at least lay the groundwork for the Berlin Enlightenment, and then we'll go to lunch. Okay. So up until now, the pieces that we've put into play are all about instability. Remembering that the big picture assertion that I'm making is that the hallmark of Enlightenment is the uncoupling of knowledge from tradition. And that tradition isn't just sort of a stuffy intellectual narrowness of perspective, of inherited knowledge, which lacks a critical perspective. Especially for Am Yisrael, tradition is embodied in structures of authority and power. As we're going to see when we go into Mendelssohn's life, that becomes increasingly important, right? Just remember Galileo, right? Who, having inherited the teachings of Copernicus, invented the technology to actually prove that indeed the sun is at the center of the solar system, hence the name, right? And he said two things. Well, he said one thing and another thing happened. What did he say? He said, don't tell me what you believe. Look into the telescope and tell me what you see. Right? That is the hallmark of the uncoupling of knowledge from tradition. We called it empiricism, if you recall. Right? And what did he get for it? Excommunicated. Because he lived in a world where tradition wasn't just an intellectual abstraction. It had systems of power. Right? And that the church was not going to allow new waves of knowledge to undermine their power and authority. We're going to speak more about that challenge today. So that's one side of what we've said, and that's the empiricist side. If you remember that the sort of roots of that really lie in the scientific revolution, the British should get an inordinate amount of credit for that, even though we named Galileo, who's of course an Italian. Right? And the catchphrase there was Newton's assertion, I feign no hypothesis. That's another way of saying uncoupling knowledge from tradition. I feign no hypothesis. I know nothing about what the world actually is. I'm just going to try to see it and then figure it out afterwards. If people here are involved in science, it may sound strange because the scientific method today is based on hypothesis in proof or disproof. Right? That's the deductive method. This was the inductive method, which was try to see the world and then sort of figure out what it is you're seeing afterwards. This is a discussion we don't need to get into. But the key is that in the empirical tradition, right, one's sensory experience is the source of all knowledge. Right? And we said, oddly enough, that there was a spiritual messianic awakening around Shabtai Tzvi, which had at least one foot in the empirical world. Right? That the prophetic tradition and the sort of more activist, mystical tradition in Judaism has one element of an empiricist stance, which is, I heard the voice of God tell me I am the Messiah. Now, to you, that may sound crazy. But to me, that's an empirical fact. Right? And it's also, of course, deeply antinomian. It breaks a lot of laws, as we saw with Shabtai Tzvi. And not just laws, it broke down a lot of rabbinic structures. Just remember that image the day after Shabtai Tzvi converts, when everybody shows up in shuls and says, so, Rabbi, what about your Messiah now? Right? That no matter what he says, Messiah is still alive and we're still Sabbateans. Or, you know, I was wrong, you know, Shamnu Bagadnu. Or whatever he says, what he's done is undermined his authority to a significant way. So the other side of the Enlightenment that we already labeled was Descartes. Right? Descartes' meditations on first philosophy, we said that the primary tool of Descartes was what? Was rational skepticism. Well, it's the mind, right? He's a rationalist as opposed to an empiricist, which means that the source of knowledge is not your senses, the source of knowledge is the rational mind, that you can actually know. But first, you have to doubt everything. Right? That's why Descartes' famous statement, I think, therefore I am, is a product of meditating upon everything he ever learned, everything he'd inherited from the past, and questioning whether it stood in its own rational light or whether he believed it, like most of us, simply because that's how we were taught. And he ends up only with one thing, which is his experience of doubt. And he says, ah, there I am. There must be an I there if I'm thinking about this. I think, therefore I am. And from there, he builds back up what he considers to be the rationalist structures of thought. Right? And you can see, obviously, why that would be an uncoupling of knowledge from tradition. Because skepticism destroys all the structures of traditional-based knowledge and asserts the idea that the human mind could actually know. It'll take a few hundred years more. Well, actually, not so many hundred years more until Kant will come along and say, well, the human mind doesn't actually know. It experiences. And then in the problem will return upon itself. It's not a class in philosophy, but just understand that skepticism doesn't intrinsically have boundaries. I'm sure we all spent some point in high school wondering whether I didn't exist or whether I was just part of a dream, right? You know what I mean? That sounds like silly sort of like meditations for a Sunday evening, but it's like it becomes a real question. Yeah. Hearing voices.
But all of his followers, they believe. So it's really the tradition much more than...
Well, it's a funny combination of both, as we spoke about, because also we said that the Sabbatean movement at its height included sort of mass prophesying, people who were swept up with the Spirit of God. Right? We also said there's this strange phenomenon that people begin as Sabbatean prophets and then end up declaring themselves as the Messiah. You are correct. I'm not arguing I'm not arguing. Meaning, I think you are correct. I'm not arguing that in the same way that Newton saw the apple fall out of the tree and said, this is an incontrovertible fact, I have to figure out why it happened, so too Shabtai Tzvi heard the voice of the Messiah, this must be true. My point is that they both come from a place which rejects inherited authority bound up with knowledge. Right? Because Shabtai Tzvi was encouraging people to engage in behaviors which were antinomian. They were law-breaking behaviors. Remember, he gave that blessing, matir isurim instead of matir asurim. God isn't just the one who looses the bound, one who permits the forbidden, right? And he's seeking, consciously or not, it'd be a deeper analysis of his story, to free Am Yisrael from the structures of the past in order to be able to enter into a new era. His era is a mystic era, and I hear what you're saying. It's bound up with some very traditional beliefs about Messiah, but it's an attempt to uncouple the future from the past, and that's why I'm interested in their overlap.
Without taking all the way back to Shabtai Tzvi,
I don't mean that. Did you give an example of what type of piece you made to be famous?
We spoke a little bit about it. I don't want to get there's, and as I pointed out, the later Frankist movement that emerged around the time, a little bit later than the Emden Eibschitz story that we ended with, colors the way we see Shabtai Tzvi. Like the later Frankist movement in Europe were involved in very strange sexual practices. There was a syncretism between certain elements of Catholicism and Judaism. And so what happens is people paint the whole picture through the lens of the later movement. But it lays a little bit beyond the scope of our discussion. So, but the key here is I want you to picture the context even before the formal beginning of the Enlightenment, which we'll talk about maybe when that would be, the tottering structures of knowledge. We spoke also, I just want to get everything in place, the power of the printing press and the lifting of the horizons of information, right? The advance of transportation and communication technology, sort of embodied by what I call the port Jews, right? These mostly Sephardi and often conversos, particularly of the Portuguese nation, right? Whose ability for travel and transport and communication exposes them to a world which the average Jew does not know, right? And they live largely a communal life unto themselves. And we spoke about, in particular with the converso existence, how it's a community which includes what we would today call Orthodox Jews, secular Jews, meaning people who are just men of the world, so to speak, and professed Catholics, and everything in between. And that opens up a completely new communal model on which that old identity of the pre-modern identity of us and them has already broken down. So these are the pieces, more or less, that we've spoken about up until now. Last but certainly not least, is the power of Spinoza. Remembering that Spinoza is the person who the converso experience, he refused to kill himself in the face of the transition. He's the one who chose to kill God. Right? That's what we spoke about last week. That Oriol de Costa, who lived two decades, before Spinoza, was a converso who actually escaped from the Iberian Peninsula seeking what he believed to be the true religion, and then he met the Jews, right? And in particular, rabbinic authority and his clash with the community caused him, let's say, he was unable to reconcile the passionate desire for freedom, which was bound up with his pursuit of the Jewish religion, and the very closed rabbinic authority he encountered in the community of Amsterdam, and he ended up killing himself, right? Spinoza was able to hold that tension within himself and came up with a philosophy which essentially killed the Jewish God. He was not an atheist, as we spoke about. I don't want to review it all. But the key, that the uniqueness of Spinoza, we said one piece. You remember what it was? The contention I made that the difference between Spinoza and every other person who broke away from Jewish history up to that point was?
He still believed in God.
Although there were others, he didn't join a new team. Or didn't join one of the old teams, so to speak. He didn't become a Christian. He didn't become a Muslim. He actually became an individual. I said in theory, in quotes, because I'm wary of, you know, sort of historical anachronism. But in essence, he forged the path for being the first secular Jew. And later, many would see him as forging the path for creating secular society within Europe. And this idea that there should be an absolute separation between the power of religion and state will have a rather large role in the development of the European Enlightenment, right? And we spoke mostly about the theological political treatise in that light, just making sure that we've got the pieces on the table. The one thing I actually didn't mention from Spinoza, which will be a nice roll over into our next phase of discussion, is that when he spoke about the Jews, Spinoza has a very interesting contention. He sees the Torah as the constitution of the national existence of the Jewish people, of Am Yisrael, really. Right? And that national existence, as is true with all national existence as far as he knows, is bound up with an embodied political existence within the land. And that's why he says, I have a paraphrase here, that detachment from country and territory that came with exile abrogated the Torah as a civil covenant. Meaning once the Jews are no longer a people in its land with a political entity, the Torah is no longer binding. It frees Am Yisrael from any meaningful obligation to the commandments. And that's why he was so disparaging of religion. But he does imply, and in a couple places almost say, that a return to the land would recreate such a thing. And he has a few very mysterious statements about circumcision, for instance, that circumcision, he said it was only in the merit of clinging to circumcision that the Jews would someday return to their land. And this is why Spinoza gets a revival amongst many of the early Zionists who see him as a proto-Zionist, which is, I don't think, so fair, but it's an interesting thought. That's exactly what it says under here. Is that no? I mean, I wrote in my notes, right? We see Rashi brings it down in last week's parsha that anyone who lives outside of the land of Israel, as if they have no God. The Ramban says, you know, that the mitzvot outside of Eretz Yisrael are tziunim, they're practiced or markers, so that you won't forget your way back, right? It's not an entirely absurd notion. It's not an entirely absurd notion, and it sets the stage for what's coming ahead, which is there such a thing as a Jew and a citizen of another land? Jew and a citizen of the Netherland. This is going to be the challenge that enlightenment and emancipation will pose. I'm jumping ahead a little bit because we haven't talked about what they are. But meaning, right now, the medieval model in Europe, and we're telling a European story for right now, for better or worse, is a corporate model. Where the Jews exist as, not like the suit and tie corporate, but like as a separate entity, both politically and culturally. Some places actually physically separated by the ghetto walls. But the key is the Jews don't exist. There is no concept of citizenship. We spoke a little bit about the Treaty of Westphalia and the beginnings of the idea of a state where political power transcends religion, and that would be the rebirth of a secular citizen model. It's not there yet in Europe. It's coming. And that's what will pose the question. So long as the Jews exist, qua Jews, as a body en masse, then frankly, whether you're religious or not doesn't matter. That's an intra-communal problem, right? Like, you ask the question, like, Rick, were there really no Jews that didn't keep the Torah all throughout Europe? Right? If you read Art Scroll, the answer is yes, of course there weren't, right? But I think that human psychology hasn't changed that much throughout history, right? And one can assume that some percentage of people found it just too hard. Nevertheless, either because of family and communal and cultural ties or because there was external pressure, they remained within the communal boundaries. Oh, excommunication definitely happened, as did conversion. And even though we say that Spinoza is the first person not to join the other team, I'm sure there were Jews who just lived a marginal existence throughout all of history. But he was the one who made an ideology out of it, right? One which proved quite viable going forward. But that corporate existence won't last into the Enlightenment. Because what's coming is the idea of the rise of the relationship between the individual and the state. And as soon as you have a rise of a model, what we call citizenship, where there's at least, I wouldn't say unmediated, but a direct relationship between citizen and state, not a corporate existence, then we'll have the question, can a Jew be a Jew in the way in which it's been conceived in the Middle Ages, rabbinic Judaism, the one-to-one relationship between law and identity, as we mapped it out in last semester, and be a citizen? That is going to be our question for today. In order to appreciate its import, I want to talk a little bit about the Enlightenment, and then we'll touch on emancipation as well. So, what is Enlightenment? We already talked about the underpinnings in empiricism and rationalism. There's one more piece that we have to add. You know, in 1784, Immanuel Kant, great philosopher of the Enlightenment, publishes an essay, fortunately, which is called Answering the Question, What is Enlightenment? So we don't have to look too far, right? Should look it up. It's a very interesting essay. He really actually Google it. That's how I found it. I just asked, what is Enlightenment? And suddenly I found Immanuel Kant, right? But here's a great quote here. He says, Enlightenment is man's emergence from his self-imposed, he calls it nonage, which means like non-existence. Nonage is the inability to use one's own understanding without another's guidance. This nonage is self-imposed if its cause lies not in lack of understanding, but in indecision and lack of courage to use one's own mind without another's guidance. Dare to know, he says. Have the courage to use your own understanding is the motto of the Enlightenment. Dare to know. So you can add to Newton's I feign no hypothesis and Descartes' sort of radical skepticism, doubt everything, which is what produces, I think, therefore I am, to now Immanuel Kant's dare to know, right? And daring to know, as you can see, is just another way of maybe indirectly, but for some directly, declaring war on all the structures of knowledge and the society which embodies them, right? And so enlightenment is not just a sort of intellectual flowering of philosophers and people who want to break free of the intellectual constructs of the church and medieval knowledge. It inevitably will produce people who also want to break away from the social and religious structures which uphold society in their day. And those structures are basically conveniently broken into estates, right? It's usually the first, second, third estates are associated with what's known as the Ancien Régime, right? The pre-revolution regime in France. There are other models in the rest of medieval Europe, but it's a good model for understanding. First estate, anybody know? Who comes first in the Middle Ages? Church. First estate's the church. Second estate? Nobility. Third estate? Commoners. Now you're wondering, where's the king? And that's a very important insight. The monarchs lie outside of the estates. It's a very important insight for what comes next. Because the first model of enlightenment political reorganization is not democracy. Right? That's a product of France, and it lasts for about 8 years, if that, if you really want to even call the National Assembly. What? Less. Sorry, if you want to call the National Assembly a democracy, is a tough. But even the aspiration for it, because Napoleon is not a Democrat, right? What's the first model? Anybody know? The first the sort of prized political model, Voltaire, as we'll speak about momentarily, was quite enamored of this notion. Enlightened absolutism. Is that what you want to do is get rid of the church, the first estate, and get rid of the nobility, the second estate. Take the third estate, which is the mass of people who've been paying all the taxes and sweating and laboring to hold those others up, and put them in direct relationship to power, which is the monarch, right? Now, you can see how, you know, who are the people holding knowledge in the Middle Ages? And the nobility, I mean, true, the church is, you know, so it's not surprising that names like Voltaire and Montesquieu and others, Montaigne, that are like the sort of highlights of the Enlightenment largely come either from a church education or the nobility or both, right? And they, in our language today, they're using their privileged position to undermine the structures of power which gave them that privilege. Well, we'll talk about enlightened absolutism. We're going to talk about it in a second. But my point is I want you to understand the structure of the estates, because now you can already see how uncoupling knowledge from tradition or daring to know is questioning the entire social and political structure which upholds the world in which you live. Now, there will always be those who want to use that new knowledge to solidify their privilege. Some things never change, right? Right? But the idea of using that knowledge to undermine the structures is going to be a very important element of the Enlightenment.
What is the United States?
The United States, in many ways, was a laboratory for more of the, I would say, the English philosophical tradition in Enlightenment.
Scottish,
fair enough. I was thinking, as an American, of that, like all those people on the island over there. But yes, Scottish is much more accurate. I don't want to get too much into European history, but there's an interesting study that can be made, and Hannah Arendt actually has a book called On Revolution, just a comparison of the American, French, and Russian revolutions. Highly, highly recommend reading it. So, I think I call her Hannah. It's Hannah Arendt. Hannah, sorry. I was at that Jewish thing in me. So, focusing, help me out here, people. So why does this matter for the Jews? Because, you know, today there's a fourth estate. What do we call the fourth estate?
Press,
right? The fourth estate is nominally any body that exists outside of that power structure. Today it's the press because, at least in its origins, the press was attempting to sort of, like, use its freedom from that structure to spread liberty and knowledge and information. I'll leave it to you what it's doing today. But in many ways in Europe, the Jews also are a fourth estate. Now, the Jews exist strangely within and outside of this structure. We spoke about, on one hand, the Jews are the serfs of the king. So they belong below the third estate. There was a fourth estate, so to speak, of people who are completely disenfranchised. On the other hand, we've spoken repeatedly about how the Jews are these sort of like very able, talented, diligent, loyal servants who are easily discarded. because they lie outside of that structure of the state. It's not so easy to discard the church or the nobility. So the Jews exist on the margins of this structure, right? And because of that, they will easily be painted into various roles, right? And a lot of the history, we're not going to get into it, not today and probably not in this class, but if you guys continue next year, the birth of modern political anti-Semitism is bound up with a perception of where the Jew fit into the old social structure and will fit or not into the new one. So this rebellious spirit, as it were, is going to inevitably take aim at the first two estates and try to create this unmediated or at least direct relationship between nobility and the king. There's another piece in this, and you can see how, by the way, when the social structure starts to break down, on one hand, good news to the Jews. I mean, the old social structure was keeping the Jews in the ghetto and excluded from large areas of land ownership and trade, education, and we'll speak about that. On the other hand, the political chaos which erupts is going to be dangerous. And I'll just say it now, we'll come back to it, who really benefits from life in the ghetto? That's an important question to ask. Who held the keys to the ghetto gates? Was it the non-Jews or was it the Jews? I don't mean literally. I mean figuratively. Whom did it serve to have a separate existence? It serves a certain model of identity. And I want to, before we get into the actual who, it serves a certain model of identity, which is we've identified the model of identity, which basically from the time of Ezra all the way until modernity, has been the means of survival for the Jewish people, which is us here and you there, right? The Converso experience is the beginnings of the ends of that. And in sort of Central Europe, when the ghetto walls begin to break down and the question of Jews as citizens, right, begins to emerge, that will be its breakdown within Central Europe. Now, it serves a model of identity, which is us here, you there, you know, communal reinforcement. There are power structures and structures of authority with both, which both embody and benefit and from that, the rabbinic structure. And by the way, there's always, throughout Jewish history, throughout probably most human history, been a marriage, sometimes literally, between the intellectual and the commercial elites within societies, right? It's very common to see the children of the big sages marrying the children of the big machers to this very day, right? Meaning those are two power bases within society, right? You guys know the golden rule, of course, right? Who has the gold makes the rules, right? This is not a new phenomenon in shul politics. I'm sure none of you have ever indulged in such a thing, but I've heard from my colleagues out there in the communal world that it can get a little bit rough, right? And so there's a model of identity which is served by the corporate existence of the Jews and the maintenance of an exclusionary boundary. There are structures of leadership, the rabbinic authority in particular, which we're going to see will become an intra-communal fight. The Jews themselves will struggle with it. So that breakdown is not going to be simple. So in addition to this, the Enlightenment raises more fundamental questions of human nature. And you'll see in a moment how these are bound up. Montesquieu is probably the best person through whom to see such a thing, right? Baron de Montesquieu, I'm not giving biographies to these people. First of all, it's not my knowledge base, and it's also not our main topic. But Montesquieu publishes a book called The Spirit of Laws, which is a classic Enlightenment work. It's elaborating a lot of the sort of early Scottish thinkers, you know, and it's probably best known for it's the place where he lays his stress on the idea of separation of powers, right, and the checks and balances where people, you know, obviously had a major impact on political theory to our day. But for our purposes, one of the underlying principles of the book is critical, is that laws and behaviors are a product of environment, says Montesquieu. Is that people, the human nature is not absolute, right? Human nature is a product of its environment. He's sometimes wacky because he treats it geographically. And so, like, you know, people who live in this type of climate have that kind of character, et cetera, stuff which, you know, once upon a time you could say, and then today either is just dismissed or considered racist or whatever. But for our key, what will this have to do with the Jews? Why does it matter that laws and behavior are a product of their environment? What does that matter to the Jews in now the dawning modern era in Europe?
So if they leave the environment,
Oh. And that's why Montesquieu becomes one of the earliest advocates of Jewish emancipation. Right? He's not a great lover of the Jews or Judaism. He still believes, he assumes even, that Christianity is superior. But he believes that despite their religion, notice the language, Jews should be granted civil rights. And he felt, why? Because emancipation itself would make the Jew a better person. That you let them out of the ghettos, and you let them out from under the thumb of the oppressive rabbis, which is a classic Christian trope, right? The oppressive rabbis, which some of us like to repeat. He says, within several generations of gaining full civil rights, Jews will practice an enlightened, purifying form of Judaism, not unlike the deism to which he adheres. Remember, deism, I didn't do that in our review, but deism is this notion, the rational God. Right? And a rational God, of course, would never command you to do anything irrational, like not wearing suits made of wool and linen. So meaning he sees much of what we consider Judaism or rabbinic Judaism or even biblical Judaism as a product of its environment. The Jew has been oppressed. By the way, have anybody here ever read Ivanhoe? Yeah, we spoke about Ivanhoe last night. It's a great book. And if you remember, Scott is actually... He is a student of Montesquieu in that sense, because when he speaks about Isaac of York, there are a few passages in which he says that basically that the Jew is a product of the oppression which has made him so. That what would we be like, he being Christian, right? If our people had been so miserably treated for generations. This is a very important shift. It sounds very noble, doesn't it? Can anybody identify the problem? It ensues Jews need improvement, which is just a little bit offensive. Although, I mean, I think all of us could use improvement, and that could be spun in a nice way. Let's face it, the Jews have not always been the exemplars of, divine morality that we long to be.
And then the result of the environment and this tradition that we have, that we go back to Sinai and hear the rules.
So it certainly abrogates any sort of claim to divinity, meaning it undermines our narrative, as we'd say today. Great. So the assumption of improvement, which could cut either ways, undermining our narrative, he was willing to cut in many directions with that, not quite as much as Voltaire, as we'll see. But okay, one much more specific problem. That's going to come with Mendelssohn. I wasn't even thinking of that one, but it opens the door for what we call a conversionist assumption, right, which really is the religious parallel to what I'm looking for, which I'll stop playing the game, which is that the entrance of the Jew into society is contingent upon checking our culture at the door. The Jew is welcome into society as a human being and not as a Jew. Right? And I want you to just remember that phrase. This was the bedrock early Enlightenment thinking. It was not anti-Semitic, at least in Montesquieu's view. Montesquieu was what we would today call a humanist. He said human beings are all the same, and the way we act are a product of our environment. The Jews have had exile and oppression, et cetera, et cetera. That's why they do all those awful things, because it doesn't like Jews per se. But if we let them out into society within a few generations, they'll be a good deist just like me, he says. So on one hand, it's very sort of liberal-minded and noble. On the other hand, don't miss. It means that a Jew enters in society contingent upon checking the culture at the door. Which means that any Jew who wants to remain a Jew, there's going to be two results. What's the entire rabbinic class and religious world going to do? Say thank you, but no thank you.
Stay in the ghetto.
Stay in the ghetto. And they're going to identify enlightenment with one of the greatest dangers. Anybody ever heard the enlightenment called the Endarkenment? The Endarkenment. You guys don't hang out at Eshet Torah enough. No, I shoot my arrows in every direction, although some of them perhaps are a little bit sharper than others. But I have a good friend and student who teaches there, and this is one of the constant struggles that he has. Who's a very firm guy, but he's very broad life experience and particularly very broadly educated, and he's often troubled by this sort of unspoken assumption that most people are not to be trusted with knowledge. Because knowledge leads you, it opens the doors out, right? Assuming that the derech is by definition a narrow path. Now, you can understand that, like, Shver Zion a Yid, it's hard to be a Jew. Doesn't just mean it's hard to be a Jew, I'd rather do something else. hard to be a Jew, meaning it's actually hard to be a Jew, right? Even in the state of Israel, you got a lot to do today. How much learning do you do? How well do you know the mitzvot? I've been discussing with my 11-year-old daughter this past Shabbat, the laws of Shabbat, and how, like, most people, even learned, well-meaning people, if they're not paying good attention, at least once a Shabbat will be Mechal Shabbat. No, I was telling it to her, so she shouldn't feel so bad, basically. Right? She did something, and I afterwards I spoke to her and said, "Oh, you know, but," and she was really heartbroken. And I said, "Don't be so heartbroken. That's life, right? It's hard to do all this stuff, and so therefore you distract or undermine the narrative. It becomes even harder. So on one hand, this idea of checking culture at the door in order to enter into society will cause the entire rabbinic structure, not the entire, but most of it, and the sort of base level of religious society to say, thank you, but no thank you. Right? This, by the way, just to tell you the story, they say that the Alter Rebbe, when Napoleon was marching on Russia, right, that he was praying for the Tsar to defeat him. Which is crazy, and the Tsar was no friend to the Jews, right? Why? Because he basically said, better that we should suffer materially and thrive spiritually than that we should actually thrive materially and suffer spiritually. Right? And that notion is still well out there in Am Yisrael today. Right? That's one side of the challenge that we'll see going forward. There is another side of the challenge, right? Which is the supposedly secular assumption of enlightened society, which you already identified, David, which is that it's not really a secular assumption. It's a Christian assumption. It is true, it's a sort of softened, and maybe even one would call it watered-down assumption, but it won't be enough. And enlightenment society itself is going to go through a lot of turmoil, and suddenly when you get the really secular ideologies, of socialism in particular, who are you going to find at the center of that socialist battle? The Jews. And modern anti-Semitism is bound up an awful lot with that nexus. So we maybe will get to that in our story. Okay, so but I want you to take away from Montesquieu, in addition to the sort of like the dare to know, rebellious, kind of deconstructive spirit of the Enlightenment, there's also the very humanist notion of deconstruction, which is people are all people, but since we're products of our environments, we can all change. And on one hand, that will be the entree of Jews into Christian society. On the other hand, will come at the price of checking culture at the door. As he says, right, happens that slavery debases, burdens, and destroys the mind, whereas liberty forms it, elevates it, and fortifies it. We make for ourselves the mind we want, and we are the true artisans of it. Right? So he opens the door. I don't want to talk too much about Voltaire, who's the other sort of like big personality that if we're going to do a review of the Enlightenment and the Jews. You know, Voltaire's complex. Raise your hand if you think Voltaire's an anti-Semite. Now, interesting. You guys haven't been exposed to this whole dialect. That's very interesting. I promise you, plug into Google, was Voltaire an anti-Semite? Your computer is going to start to like smoke out the ears. It's like, was he an anti-Semite? Really? But it really depends on who you ask. I'll tell you what this is, that Voltaire did not love why does it matter what Voltaire thought? Because Voltaire becomes the sort of archetypical personality of the Enlightenment, right? Satirist, author, philosopher, writes the philosophical dictionary, which serves as a basis for a lot of thought which comes after him. He has an association politically that we'll speak about momentarily. But in many ways, he's just a cultural emblem. And so therefore, when people try to orient themselves to an enlightened worldview, right, looking to Voltaire, right, poses questions. Professor Arthur Hertzberg, has a strong contention that Voltaire is the gateway or the bridge between classic medieval anti-Semitism and modern medieval Jew hatred and modern anti-Semitism. All right, we'll speak more about that perhaps next year, depending on where we get in this five-part series. Voltaire represents another side of the Enlightenment. And what was his problem with the Jews? First of all, he had a problem with all organized religion. It's funny, if you look through his writings, it seems that the less he knew about the religion, the more he was willing to like give it a pass. Like, you know, so like the Far Eastern religions, he has like a very, what we would call an Orientalist attitude toward them. He's like an idealized, it looks very nice, and I've never really encountered it. So, but you know, he didn't spare on Christianity, he didn't spare on Islam, he didn't spare on the Jews. There are lots of questions about his personal relationship with the Jews, and they're mixed. He was one of the most prolific writers of the Enlightenment. So So to say that he, you know, he said X, Y, and Z, and that makes him an anti-Semite, it may or may not be true, but you have to consider how much he actually wrote. However, one of the things that, Voltaire does introduce into the discourse is what we would today call racial theory. Voltaire, did I write down his birth dates? He's an 18th century writer. I think he may have been born in 1719, but he certainly doesn't live to see the French Revolution. He dies right before the Revolution. I'm looking at some of the essays that I wrote down the dates on are 1771, and he was an 18th century philosopher. Somebody wants to just plug in Voltaire and find out the dates of birth and death, that would be great. But Yeah. His height of literary fame is like 1750 to 1770 or something like that. There you go. Thank you. I knew he didn't see the Revolution. I'm curious. It's kind of like Ruff Cook never saw the state. It's interesting. There's two things that I just want to throw out there, and because we're going to have to carry them forward. Number one, racial theory. Voltaire had some thoughts which were not uncommon in his day. That a little bit unlike Montesquieu, that each race has separate origins, and the Jews in particular are of an Asiatic origin, right? And this will be one of the things that he hands off to modern racial anti-Semitism. This idea that the Jews are a foreign element. Now it's strange because you can find places in Voltaire where he will say the Jews are our brothers, the Jews, Christians, Hindus, meaning everybody. He's a universalist ethic. Everybody's the same. But in other places, you'll find racial theory. This is what I'm saying. It's not so easy to peg him. But as is always true, because of his stature, people later who want to claim that there is a legitimate intellectual roots to their hatred will go back and point to Voltaire. So that's why I'm not weighing in on whether he was an anti-Semite or not. We never met, right? And my experience of reading quite a number of essays on the question is it depends on who you ask. Right, you could definitely cull from his works. I've got some great quotes here that are just doozies. Right, but the thing that's for sure true is that you can understand how sort of a racial theory, some proto-genetic racial theory, would contribute to the problem. But what's more interesting to me actually, and I want to understand it because it informs the Enlightenment altogether, is how his belief in universalist moral and ethical principles made him an enemy of the Torah. It's something that we often forget about, especially in the 21st century, where the Jews at this point, the majority of the Jews of the world lean toward the universal. But we forget, it's certainly at first glance, and certainly without the rabbinic structure around it, the Torah is an extremely particularist story. It is a tribal story. My God takes me out of slavery. Does that teach me that all people should be free? Nope. It teaches me that when my God gets me to the land, I'm going to kill everybody and take it. Right? And it's true that's obviously a gross oversimplification. And it's true, obviously, that our sages in particular labored to bring out the tension between the universal and the particular within the text. But to ignore that fact is to ignore the historical context of the Torah, whatever you believe it was. God, Moses, Sinai, committee through the generations, I don't care, right? The key is that the Torah, as we spoke about last semester, right, revelation is parochial. If you believe in literal revelation, that means there was a God, a Moshe, and there was a bunch of people standing at a mountain called Sinai. They had a certain language, they came from a particular culture, and they ate something for breakfast that morning. That's like parochial. It's a local. It's not universal ethical truth. Even if you believe it was written by a committee through time, it is a committee through time produced by particular cultures. That's one of the bases of like high criticism, trying to identify the different cultures in the layers of the text. But that's still parochial. It makes no argument for being universal ethical principles. That's the realm of philosophy. Right? This idea that philosophical truths are universal truths. Right? Philosophical truths are supposed to be universal truths. Just always remember, Socrates is a man. All men are mortal. Ergo, Socrates is? Right, you can't argue with that, right? I don't care where you're from. Right? That it's a little bit of a silly example, but it is apt, because what it shows you is that philosophy purports to be universal. And so Voltaire, and in his wake, most of the Enlightenment thinkers are very bothered by the particularist elements of the Torah. Of course, in this, they're aided by what tradition that they're also inheritors of? Christianity, which surprisingly, right, attempted to universalize the Torah by doing what? Getting rid of the historical, physical reality of the Jewish people. And you're going to see a pattern here. Right? Is that if you want, in the minds of first Christianity, and then sort of the philosophical enlightened inheritors of Christian culture, if you want to redeem the ethical teachings of the Torah, which Voltaire did not, but he just saw it as this like sort of almost barbarically particularist, but if you say you did because you wanted to preserve your Christian heritage, so the number one thing you need to get rid of is the historical physical embodiment of the Jews, particularly those who are still not wearing suits made of wool and linen, because that's just silly. Right? And you happen to notice that those people who don't wear suits made of wool and linen tend to be a little bit clannish and tribal. And they're the ones that actually might not mind so much that those barriers stand between us and society. So you can see this tension will begin to reinforce itself. There's one last piece, just because you got to paint Voltaire a full picture, is that he is an ethical hedonist. Ethical hedonist. Voltaire, I mean, people are familiar perhaps from just general knowledge with his sort of romantic life, right? But Voltaire wasn't just a libertine, right? He was a philosophical libertine. He believed in hedonism, that the pursuit of pleasure was an ethical principle, right? And you can understand why that would run smack into like Christian and Jewish culture, right? And why particularly would cause him to let loose all kinds of arrows on the silly and hypocritical behavior of the church and the Bible, because the Bible's got some fishy sexual stories. I don't know if you've read it. But that's going to matter for us, because right there at the base of Enlightenment culture, which is one of the major contributors to modern and postmodern secular culture, will lie this notion that the pursuit of pleasure is an ethical good. Sound familiar? Right? And it will take a long time for it to make a sort of a explicit emergence, because Christian culture, desacralized, but nevertheless Christian culture, will still remain the sort of social cultural base. But when it is truly deconstructed, what will be left is the hedonist ethic. Hedonist ethic, this idea that the pursuit of pleasure is right and good. Remember, hedonism doesn't necessarily mean like disgusting, immoral behavior. Hedonism just means that the pursuit of pleasure is an ethical principle. Your pleasure might be, I don't know, sipping tea and reading Jane Austen novels on a Sunday afternoon. I don't know. But if you believe that that is the highest form of good, then that's an ethical assertion. So therefore, you would want to structure your society around the ability, if you have a utilitarian ethic along with it, which he did, of the majority of people being able to spend most of their time sipping tea and reading Jane Austen. Okay. So that's the picture of the Enlightenment. It's a rather long-winded picture, I see. So we're going to come to Lessing when we get to the story of Mendelssohn, because they had friends. Although less about his he's going to be a straw man for the bridge of Mendelssohn into society, because I think it was enough to get a sense of. I apologize if this seemed like a lot about European society, but it's important to understand where the Jew is landing here. Other questions or comments? Okay, so we're going to shift gears into the actual story. So young Moses, son of Menachem, also known as Mendelssohn, right? He's born in Dessau, Germany in 1729. On his mother's side, he's actually descendant of the Ramah, right? Of Moshe Isserles, the great sort of halachic thinker of Ashkenaz of Poland, who we didn't speak about, but we'll get to next year. Classic story, diligent scholar. Right, he's recognized that he's on the road for the rabbinate. We've told this story so many times, right? He's quickly actually taken under the wing of the rabbi of Dessau, who happens to be Rav David Frankel, if you're familiar with the Korban Eda on the Yerushalmi. He's the author of the Korban Eda. Very impressive work. From age 11, he's there until in 1743, his life takes an important turn where Rabbi Frankel is called to Berlin. Dessau is a relatively small community. And young Moshe leaves his physical father and goes with his father in Torah. He goes with him to Berlin. The legend is that he walks all the way. Already at the time, he had a frail constitution. And then when he gets to the gates of Berlin, he's questioned by the Jewish guards waiting for him. Now, why are the Jewish guards waiting for him? Because there's a quota on the number of Jews who can live in Berlin at the time. Only those who are economically productive are allowed in. Right, this is the reality of German life. You have to remember at the time, all that Enlightenment stuff I just told you is like bubbling up through the cracks in France, in certain parts of the German states, right? But by and large, most of... What?
Not under the Kaiser.
No, not under the Kaiser, right? And by and large, most Jews in Central Europe still live within the medieval structures, and in the German states, they were particularly oppressive about population quotas, and you have to get marriage licenses to even get married, etc. So, but he's allowed into the city because the Jews, the community, reserves the right to a certain limited number of scholars, which it will support. So he says, I've come for nothing else other than to learn Torah. And they, of course, say, oh, thank God, we need more people like that in the city, and they let him in. So he claims later that the turning point in his life is in 1742, actually. Well, I mean, he happens to encounter the book in 1743 when he gets to Germany. But in 1742, Israel ben Avraham, who was a Christian convert to Judaism, such things do happen, owned a printing house near Dessau, and he reprints the Rambam's Guide for the Perplexed. Now, the Mor Nevuchim, today you'd think, I mean, how many printings of the Mor Nevuchim have there been? I don't know. This was the first printing in 200 years in Central Europe. Right? It had fallen off the bookshelves. Remember, I told you back in our discussions of the Rambam controversies 1, 2, and 3 that the Rambam served as the spearhead of philosophical heresy into the heart of traditional Judaism. Because the Rambam's rationalist stance, the idea that there are two paths to one truth, right? All the way back to Sadia Gaon, those of us who have been together for the whole semester, right? There are two paths to one truth, that revelation and reason can both reach the same conclusion, for most people, is inaccessible, as he says fairly enough in his introduction to the Guide to Perplexed. For a certain next percentage leads to them to completely abandon revelation, because to reconcile the two is very hard. And then there's an even smaller number who actually manage to think like the Rambam thought. So it was reprinted presumably in Hebrew. Although, I mean, it was written originally in Arabic, so I'm imagining this was Ibn Tibbon's translation. I don't know. I could look into it. I don't think it was in German. Anyway, he couldn't read German at this point. And if it had been anything, it would have been Latin, because they weren't, I mean, use the use of German vernacular for scholarly works at this point was really just getting off the ground. My guess is it would have been Ibn Tibbon's translation into Hebrew. But why does this matter? You know, years later, Mendelssohn would actually attribute his physical weakness and his hunch, he had a hump, his curvature of his spine, to the hours he spent poring over Maimonides. And he imbibed what he called the Rambam's ideal, that those capable of profound thought are obligated to aspire to perfection and to recognize the truth in God by means of their intellect. Right? That's the quote, Yirmiyahu, that let not the wise man boast of his wisdom, nor the strong man of his strength, nor the rich man of his riches, but let him that boasts exult in this, that he understands and knows me. So you can hear how he knows nothing of the Enlightenment yet, but you can hear how he's now cultivated the assumption that what it is to serve God is to know. Now, he comes from a traditional background, right? And so therefore, for him, the Rambam is the source of knowledge. But you don't learn even Jewish philosophical traditions without a teacher. He meets in Berlin Yisrael Samos. I'm sure I'm saying that wrong. Samoscz, right? Who is a rabbi and teacher of the time. He's a rabbi and teacher in the school of the classic Sephardic thought, which means that science and philosophy are assumed to be the handmaidens of learning Torah. There's a bit of a debate who goes first, right? But that's one of the major distinctions. We didn't speak because we jumped over early modernity, but it's a major split between what emerges as Ashkenazic culture of Torah. Although maybe you remember back in the third Rambam controversy when the Rosh proudly declared that he'd never read a word of Aristotle, right? Meaning that he had kept himself pure in Torah. That's more of the Ashkenazic tradition as opposed to the Rambam and many other great minds of the sort of pre-expulsion Sephardic tradition, who assumed that philosophy was a tool of wisdom. And so, but Somoza was deeply bothered by the contempt that rabbinic scholars held for what they called sort of like chokhma chitzonit, any external wisdom, science, philosophy. And he wasn't the only one in Berlin bothered by that sense of cultural inferiority to the Christians. He's aware of what's going on. Berlin at the time is a major city, and he sees the sort of intellectual progress and the flowering of culture happening around him. And he sees that the response to the Jews is either total ignorance, they don't even know what's going on, or the assumption that it must be bad. And so he along with another sort of like a small group of scholars, he dedicates himself to trying to save neglected Jewish texts on science, philosophy and learning. And he draws Mendelssohn into this circle. And under Somoza's influence, at age 16, he actually begins attending lessons in the gymnasium, right? High school, basically, what we would think of it, although it's not really high school because it includes many classes that we would think of as advanced learning, but that's the age bracket, not necessarily the curriculum. Without abandoning his Torah studies, at this time he strives to master German, French, and English in order to access the philosophical literature of the time. That's what he's after, right? He just wants to know. It's amazing. The story is that the first Enlightenment work he ever studied was Locke's Essay Concerning Human Understanding, which is considered like a classic. But if you want to appreciate what you're dealing with, is the Essay on Human Understanding is written in Latin, which Mendelssohn did not read. So therefore, he taught himself with a dictionary to read Latin through translating the essay. Right? And by the time he was done translating the essay, he not only read the essay, but he could read Latin. In 1753, Mendelssohn, one of his friends, brought him to the Berlin Scholars Club, which was known as the Learned Coffee House. Coffee houses of this era of history play a very interesting role in terms of the sort of intersection of multiple estates. You know, they're kind of a free space of intellectual discourse where the noblemen and sort of like sketchy clergy and like the students of the day, well, you know, I say sketchy clergy because no honest clergyman would go to a coffee house, right? Coffee. And basically it was gathering, a weekly gathering of mathematicians, you know, scientists, philosophers, theologians, and they would get together and read papers, debate, and discuss. And at first he just sat as a spectator. But it was here that he met Gotthold Ephraim Lessing. This is where he meets Lessing, and if people know some of the story of Moses Mendelssohn, is that Lessing at the time was already a well-known writer and philosopher. He would go on to be one of the most influential thinkers of the German Enlightenment, and he became very enamored of young Moses Mendelssohn. There's all kinds of stories about the relationship. I don't think they're so critical, especially considering the time frame, but Lessing was just overwhelmed by this sort of like Cinderella story, for lack of a better term, of like the Jewish wunderkind who teaches himself to learn foreign languages and to adapt to an alien culture. And he begins to move deeper and deeper into the scholarly elite of Berlin. And one of the stories I saw is that the first paper that Mendelssohn tried to present in this coffee house, I forget what the topic was, it was a philosophical argument for the existence of God, something along those lines, which was one of his major efforts through his whole life. Right? He had someone else read it. He was too embarrassed. He said it was read anonymously. But then the person said something wrong. It was a wrong translation, maybe, and he called out from the back, and he outed himself. Everyone turns around and sees like the Jewish kid in the corner, like, you. So,
was Lessing Jewish?
No, Lessing was not Jewish. Lessing was not only not Jewish, but Lessing, if we're going to sort of name any important moment in his story with Mendelssohn, in 1754, Lessing publishes a play entitled Die Juden. The Jews, not like Die Juden, right? It's a German, right? It's not a mix. The idea was it was meant to confront the viewer, I guess it's a play, right? Or the reader, with all the stereotypes current in Christian culture about the Jews. The lying Jew, the morally inferior Jew, culturally backwards, and basically it was a protest play against the barriers that he believed kept the Jews in that state. You can hear sort of the Montesquieu-type Enlightenment thinking there. You know, and this is like classic Enlightenment, right? Drama as a tool for moral education. Lessing even said somewhere that the theater should be a school of the moral world, right? And what's interesting is that one of the professors at Göttingen University, he published a review, a critique of Die Juden, And his critique was very simple. A good play is committed to putting real-life characters on stage. And he failed when he chose a preposterous character who everyone knows doesn't exist, an upright, moral Jew. Right? But in Lessing's... I want you to understand something, is you cannot hear that simply through the lens of Jew hatred. You cannot hear that simply through the lens of Jew. I mean, yes, it's likely there as well. When Michaelis wrote that Jews are hostile towards Christianity by the very nature of their religion, and immoral by virtue of their occupation with trade, which almost by definition makes them thieves, right? What he's identifying is a social ill. But, you know, to say that the Jews aren't hostile to their neighbors, I think is being a little bit disingenuous. Especially here at the tail end of the Middle Ages, there was no love lost between the Jews and the non-Jews. And remember, there's a significant, as the Enlightenment begins to creep in on the edges of the communal structures, there's a significant awareness growing that that which keeps us separate is what keeps us safe. Right? And furthermore, the psychology, which I'm sure no one here has ever internally experienced, but you may have seen it in your friends and neighbors, the psychology of superiority, which is a very important psychological tool of survival, that when you're surrounded by a world which tells you you are inferior and you have been replaced, to have internalized the notion that you are actually superior is an important survival tool. At the same time, it comes at a real cost, which is that if you are unable then to meet, you know, what we call begova arba einayim, just look someone straight. If you either have to be the oppressed or the oppressor, so then you are setting up a very dangerous dynamic associated with emancipation. You understand the challenge? So, and furthermore, the reality is that there is David Ben-Gurion. I'll put it this way. David Ben-Gurion actually, one of his great worries about creating a Jewish society was that he saw that how over literally a couple thousand years, the Jews had internalized the notion that law and order was an issue to be overcome. Think about it. I mean, for most of European history, law and order was in the service of oppression for the Jews. So therefore, law and order is a problem to be overcome. And he said that he saw in the society that he was attempting to build that this extended to general politeness, law-abiding citizenry. No, I'm not kidding. These are quotes. Paying one's taxes. All the things that were the sort of small manifestations of what Ben-Gurion called mamlachtiut, right? Sort of like a citizen orientation to society. He believed one of the great challenges of creating a Jewish society because Jewish culture had lived in response to the notion that law and order were a challenge to be overcome. Now, again, it's not the only force in play, and I'm wary of sort of the internalizing of anti-Semitic tropes. Nevertheless, it needs to be recognized that Michaelis is not just speaking in a vacuum. Right? So needless to say, that article both angered and humiliated Mendelssohn, but it evoked a crucial response. This article that when Michaelis criticized Lessing's play, saying, come on, if you're going to make a play, you got to have believable characters. And it was probably the sort of almost dismissive nature of it that really hurt, right? It wasn't even polemic. It was just like, please. The key is that it evoked within Mendelssohn a realization that was going to shape basically the rest of his life. And it was the realization that so long as Jews are absorbed in their own intra-Jewish discourse, they have no ability to respond to such hatred and prejudice. They have no ability to begin to change outwardly their perception or inwardly their behavior. And there's a series of letters and essays which followed on both sides back and forth. And it's from this point on that we see Mendelssohn had shifted his calling from beyond sort of a purely philosophical study. At this point, he really believed in philosophy as the end being of existence, to more what we would call social responsibility, right? He had his responsibility, which he saw, as it said here, rooted in reason, natural rights, and humanism, to assert that the Jew is a human being. You know? And now, I hope we all agree that this is true. The question is, does he fall into the same trap that many of his Enlightenment companions fell into, which is the Jew is a human being as a human being, but not necessarily as a Jew. Now that, by the way, I can tell you the answer is very simple, no. Mendelssohn remains a religious Jew in every sense of the word till the day he dies. And all the sort of myths around his life about how he discarded his religion and all this stuff are just that. They are myths. And there are questions that we'll speak about how things play out. That I'm not, you know. But his belief is that the flaw in Enlightenment thinking is that for a Jew to be a human being, they have to check their culture at the door. He does not accept that premise. And he therefore then devotes his life to trying to fight that battle internally and externally. Externally, right, he was going to now engage in philosophical discourse with all the minds of his day, asserting that Jews had a right to entry into society based on their simple fact of being humans, without any preconditions. Internally, and this is where he put just as much of his effort, he wanted to bring the light of reason to his own people. Right? In order to do this, we'll speak about a few works of authorship he had, and that will really round out his story. But questions or comments up till now before we start into a little bit of his more activist phase? Yeah?
Also, Lessing does not think like that, or at least does not write like that.
Right, like Montesquieu.
Yeah.
No, he agrees. He sees eye in eye with Mendelssohn. That's how it seems, at least. Yeah, it was not a universal. But it was this sort of blanket assumption. And I do want to stress that you know, 20/20 hindsight is always brilliant. At the time, it seemed like a very enlightened stance. To go from the fact that there is no place for the Jew in society to the idea that there is a place for the Jew in society was a big step. And by the by, not to make comparisons, but I think that there are a lot of similarities historically. It's very similar to what the LGBTQ community is fighting in civil society today, which is like the whole don't ask, don't tell posture, which is, oh, you're welcome in society as long as you're not who you are, right? And what's happening now is it a pushback saying, well, no, if we're welcome in society, then we're welcome in society.
As who we are.
I mean, obviously, we're welcome to society, full stop. Like, you know, and you can have whatever opinion you want on that. I'm not taking stances, but my point is that this dynamic of extending what we could say enfranchising beyond tolerance into real citizenship is a dynamic that human society has struggled with for literally millennia. And the Jews have a particular challenge here, which is that we hold very fast to the importance of our identity, right? Because we didn't hold fast to the importance of identity, so it wouldn't be such a big price to pay.
Mm-hmm. I just wonder, is there any way that these great minds, Montesquieu and Voltaire, is pushing back against the obvious feeling by Jews that we are a superior culture?
Yeah. In Voltaire, you can find it a lot. I mean, Montesquieu didn't really speak about the Jews per se. It wasn't really of such interest to him. He was just interested in humanity as a whole. Voltaire had a bee in his bonnet about the Jews. I think I wrote down some of the numbers. Whatever, it doesn't matter. He's quite more engaged in the idea. And yeah, it's for sure true. You know, there's a story, just to give you some context. Wilhelm Marr. Anybody know who Wilhelm Marr was? He's a German journalist who is credited, at least, with coining the term anti-Semitism. He is part of the whole political anti-Semitic movement in 19th century. I don't know if he actually ever became mayor of anything, but the key is that Marr wrote a work, The Struggle of the German Spirit versus the Jewish Spirit. And that's where this concept of modern anti-Semitism came from. Why am I telling you the story? Because in some of his other writings, he tells a story that there was a German-Jewish community. He's trying to explain why he thinks the Jews are an anathema to German culture. So there's a German-Jewish community where the rabbi was invited to dine with the Kaiser, with the Holy Roman Empire. So the rabbi goes, rumor gets back to the community that he actually ate at this banquet, and they remove him from his position. A further investigation shows, well, the rabbi didn't actually eat. He's just, you know, as we say, chacham, Einav Berosho. He saw what was coming. So he like moved stuff around on his plate to make it look like he ate. Because, you know, when the emperor serves you food and you say no thank you, and then he says, what's the matter? You don't like the food? Well, like, I won't eat your food, you guy. Right? That's not going to end well. Right? So, but the community still wouldn't reinstate him because he'd made it look like he ate the food. So Mar says, how are we supposed to reconcile with these people? Right? They'll remove a man from leadership because he made it look like he shared the table with the emperor. This is a real problem. This is a real problem. Right, meaning it's a real problem because there is an element of both Jewish religion and Jewish culture and certainly of Jewish history which demands otherness. And how we reconcile that, I can give you all kinds of apologetics, I can give you even real answers, but I'm not going to do it right now. Because the reality is you put your finger on a very important point, and Mendelssohn himself feels it very deeply, which is why not only does he turn outward and begin this discourse with all these sort of Enlightenment philosophers and arguing how the Jew should be allowed into society as the Jew, he turns inwards and tries to reform, I use that word deliberately, Jewish culture. And his first vehicle for that, thank you for the question, it's called Kohelet Musar. It's a collection of what he called new Hebrew literature. He publishes it in Berlin sometime in the late 1750s. His desire was basically to bring the beauty that he'd have found in Enlightenment culture to his people. And one of his major topics, and granted there were only two editions that were ever printed, was how Hebrew language had been neglected and needed to be elevated once again. He called for the revival of Hebrew, renewed biblical study, and the creation of a new literature out of this most perfect of languages. This should sound familiar to anyone who knows anything about the Jewish Enlightenment and in particular sort of the roots of Zionism. Yeah. So you will find that many of the things which others went on to actually, because by the way, he apparently was a wonderful thinker, a terrible publisher. There were only ever two editions of Kohelet Musar that were ever published. But he also cites the example of all these other European peoples who are reviving their language. He says, why are we dreaming and inert? Why do we not apply their example to our language, which is most eminent and ancient? Right? Why are we dreaming and inert? Right? You hear what's coming. Now, this is being written in the 1750s, where most of European Jewry is blissfully unaware of anything happening outside of its own particular realm. But what's happening in Europe is that the forces of Enlightenment are moving toward emancipation, right? And they're moving toward freeing up the sort of cultural powers which had been held in check by powers of structure. And he's already sensing that one of the most, if not the most for humanity, powerful vehicles for organization and for articulation is, of course, language, right? And he will have more to say about that. What's that question? Mendelssohn. Right? He's not generally seen as one of the fathers of what's called the Hebrew Renaissance, but indeed he deserves that title in concept, if not actually in practice. He also becomes a sort of a vehement champion, both within the Jewish community and outside of it, of what's called natural theology, right? This idea that that philosophical study is the way to know God and to, even without revelation, to grasp the truth of creation. The quote he has is, our common God is not the God of the Jews or Christians, but the God of all human beings. Now you can understand how, perhaps to the modern ear, that sounds very heartening. But to a world which still holds the sort of cultural, political, and religious structures of the Middle Ages, it's deeply threatening. Because most of the world is still bound up in what we called last semester the hermeneutic battle. Remember what the hermeneutic battle is? Hermeneutic battle is that who gets to read the story in the right way? Right? And not only who gets to read the story about the past in the right way, who can read the story of the past in a way that justifies my present identity and will get it to the future I want? Right? When you read the 53rd chapter of Isaiah, is that about the Jewish people or is it about Jesus of Nazareth? Right? Like that's a very important question for the Jews of the Middle Ages. And you know what? You know what Mendelssohn's telling you? No, it's not. There's only one God, and you don't need revelation to know that. And so all these polemics are taking place on a misguided plane. It's not that he doesn't care about the Bible. Don't misunderstand me. It's just that it is not now, and again, he's clearly drawing on the tradition of the Rambam and of Sa'adja before him, it is not the sole source of divine knowledge. And perhaps not even the best one. That's one of the questions that we'll have to just leave in suspense about Mendelssohn. So he continues to grow in his philosophical achievements outwardly, even as he's doing this sort of beginnings of trying to enlighten his community inwardly. Just to give an example, in 1763, he takes first prize in an essay contest at the Royal Academy of Sciences. Just to give you some context, Kant also entered, but he only got a commendation. not even second, not even. It was just commendation. Maybe that's what you call second prize. But the key is that the essay was an assertion that philosophy could include genuinely objective arguments, which if you know anything about Kant, which is why they were arguing, right? And it was basically a rational philosophical proof of the existence of God. And Mendelssohn would play a very important role in that respect for holding a lot, not just Jewish, but a lot of even non-Jewish thinkers within the realm of what we're going to call deism. This idea that you can actually be a rational thinking person and believe in God, something today which is under deep assault once again. You don't have to think that I'm rational, by the way. One more piece in the philosophical, and then we'll go back to his Jewish story, and I'll round it out. You know, he was, after all, also a human being. In 1762, Mendelssohn gets married. And just to understand, he doesn't just get married. He apparently falls madly in love. And his courtship and marriage with Frumit Guggenheim is held up by later Maskilim, the later sort of Jewish enlighteners, as an ideal of romantic marriage. Right? You have to remember that this is not just a philosophical struggle. It's not even just a religious struggle. There's a social cultural revolution happening in Europe. And romantic love is one of the hallmarks of that revolution. I'm sure we've all seen Fiddler on the Roof. Right? But just contemplate the importance of that question, do you love me? Yes, for sure. And you know how many of these people have read Shakespeare? No, don't forget, we all read Shakespeare in high school because they made us, right? But and you are correct. The social revolutions don't happen in a day, they don't even happen in a century. Romantic love begins probably before Shakespeare, one could argue, maybe Chaucer, at least But the key is that the idea that finding a life partner is not a product of the social structure, but rather of one's inner experience and choice of freedom is symptomatic. So I'm just putting it out there. It was really just kind of a springboard. They had 10 children, so they remained traditional in that respect. But the first birth ended in tragedy. And that tragedy, as is often true of tragedy in life, gave birth itself to a tremendous contribution to his personal story and to European culture. Because he was broken by this idea that he had attempted to bring a life into the world, and that life had and he died. The baby died soon after birth, and so therefore the question of the immortality of the soul became a sudden sort of urgent existential question. He went on a quest to find logical proof for the existence of the soul, and the result was the book Phaedon. I think it's pronounced Phaedon, Phaedon. It's named after one of Plato's discourses. Hang on, I lost my place in my notes here. I wrote down specifically where you got the name in. It's a classic Platonic dialogue, Phaedo, where Socrates argues the immortality of the soul before his own death. So he's building on, and this is, by the way, it was this work, and it became one of the most popular works in Europe in his day. It was one of the widely read German books of the day, translated into several languages. First edition sold out within 4 months, right? A total of 11 editions were published while he was still alive. That's an average of one every 2 years, which in the mid-18th century is just like, that's bestseller status beyond imagination. Why? Why was a book, which is a philosophical exposition of the immortality of the soul, such a bestseller? And in that sense, it shows us the role that Mendelssohn played in European society. It also opens up for us what I believe to be one of the very important roles that the Jewish people can play in modern and postmodern society. And that is, you know, that this uncoupling of knowledge from tradition feels liberating. You're throwing off superstition, you know, and you're getting rid of all of the sort of strictures of society, right? But you're also getting rid of all the ways in which you knew how to know the world. And in particular, the substitution of rational philosophy, well, it's based on one of two things, empiricism, but frankly, most people don't have the focus of mind to take an empiricist approach to life, to really only trust the data of your senses and to derive your understanding of existence from that. Most people aren't even paying that much attention to their lives. And rational skepticism for most people gets as far as skepticism. Right? Because most people, once they deconstruct, either don't have the capacity, to be honest with you, or don't put the effort into reconstruct. Don't forget, Descartes reconstructs an entire philosophy. You can like his philosophy or not, the dualism and all the problems there. I don't care. But the deconstruction down to I think, therefore I am is the beginning of the process. But most of Europe doesn't make it that far. And so therefore, what's happening is what the great sociologist Max Weber calls the disenchantment of society. Because unbeknownst to most people, they lived in a magical world. Because what religion offers is a sense of magic, hope, and life. Now, by magic, I don't necessarily mean incantations. By magic, I mean that there is a capacity for agency and causality in the world which is not bounded by the rational mind. Right? And so like Weber has a very beautiful image that he presents, that it's true that the ancient world was sort of dark and full of superstition, but it was dark and full of superstition in the same way that an enchanted forest is. Right? So on one hand, it may be scary, but on the other hand, it's very magical.
So I have a question. The immortality of his soul, was this book using logic and reason to come to the conclusion, to address the question of the immortality of the soul, which would have been, whereas before there was that separation, this was bringing back.
Yes, and as a Jew, he's uniquely positioned to do it. Because, which he never denies, the bedrock of his reality is that a good God who cared enough to grace creation with the Torah and the soul, right? But he's not going to try to prove it to you that way. That's just who he is. What he's going to do then is marshal his philosophy, which is, if you're familiar with European, you know, sort of Enlightenment philosophy, he's an optimist in the school of Leibniz. He really believes that the world is the best of all places, right? Best of all possible places. And he rejects the sort of what he calls radical, frivolous philosophy, especially of Voltaire, interestingly enough, and the French Enlightenment. Because he sees a life without God and the submission to base instincts as the greatest of all evils that threaten mankind. Right? And later in his life, which it looks like we'll finish up his story next week, which is fine, because Jerusalem is kind of a bridge to a different phase of the German Enlightenment. But later in his life, what follows on the heels of the Enlightenment? Romanticism, and there's a retreat from this belief that the rational mind, that reason is the highest tool, right? And he is very concerned that when one abandons God, that no one really crowns reason. That when one abandons God, what people crown is their own base instincts, right? You know, we call that in our tradition idolatry, right? That the worship of a portion of oneself is one of the hallmarks. What are the two great idolatrous cults? The death cult and the cult of lust. So, well, like, fear meaning fertility and death, right? And fear and desire are expressions of the two basic emotions, right? So he's saying that there is an instinct which one quickly replaces, with which one quickly replaces God. So I want to say it again. He sees that modern man needs new anchors in order not to be swept into sort of an atheistic despair or gross hedonism, remember Voltaire, right? And that it was the fear of death which was casting its shadow over the world of enlightenment. That's why in his eyes Phaedon sold so well. And what he was able to offer was his sense of being. Where's his optimism based? His optimism is not really a philosophical optimism. He may have constructed the philosophical, it's an optimism of being. Remember, faith is not a belief, it's a way of being. It's a way of walking in the world. Right? And he's walking in the world, the child of a good God who gave the Torah to creation because humanity is eminently redeemable. Right? And that's who he is. And what he does is marshal the tools of philosophy to make that accessible to those who don't share his way of being. Right? And so the power of those two, I mean, I personally, at the risk of showing my hands of what I think the purpose of the Jewish people is, this is what it is. I mean, there's a way of being in the world, and then there's an obligation to always marshal the tools of the day to share the wisdom of that way of being with those who don't necessarily share it, right? That's why what the Jewish people have to teach the world doesn't depend on believing in God, right? It doesn't depend on being a Jew. It doesn't depend on being anything other than a person who believes that the world can actually go somewhere good and that it depends on our sort of mutual obligations to one another. So the Phaedon, which again is the defense of the simplicity and immortality of the soul, is what earns Mälzen the title of the German Socrates, right? But when we'll finish with this, I got 3 minutes left here, unless you think that being the German Socrates is all good, you know, Mendelssohn was a deep threat to many, basically to all traditional society. In that sense, he was a classic Enlightenment philosopher. He was perceived as a threat by his own society, as we'll speak out that part of his story next week with the birth of the German Enlightenment of the Jews, the Jewish Berlin. It's called the Berlin Enlightenment. And he was also a threat to Christian society because, you know, he was a breach in the walls that separates between the Jews and the Christians, that we've already made clear. And his hope is that this whole age of walls is over, that liberal humanism, which is the philosophical stance that he saw carrying Europe, was going to sweep away superstition, fear, hatred. Everybody would see each other as human beings, one race together in the light of reason. And because he was the Jewish voice of his society, he became a prime target for conversion. Now, the story is that in April of 1763, a group of enlightened European youth made the pilgrimage to Berlin, which was the heart of the German Enlightenment, which was in many ways the heart of Enlightenment of the day. And of course, you got to visit the German Socrates when you're in town. So they came to him, and amongst that group was a young man named Johann Lavater. He was a young theology student from Zurich, and he kept pressing Mendelssohn to share his views on religion and specifically on the divinity of Jesus of Nazareth. Right? Mendelssohn just said, put him off, until finally in their last conversation, after receiving promises that no one would repeat what he said, Mendelssohn said he was prepared to state with caution that he had very little knowledge of Christianity personally, but he bore no hatred toward the Christian and respected the morality of Jesus' character. Doesn't sound like such an outrageous statement. In fact, there are others, and I have them here, but for the sake of time, I'm not going to quote them. There are others, Rav Yaakov Emden amongst them, who had said similar things in his day. But what it did was it opened up the door for the hope in this young man's heart that indeed this big Jew would fall. And about 5 years later, he got a package in the mail. And it was a copy of a book called The Philosophical Critical Inquiries Concerning Christianity. And the introduction had been written by none other than this young man, Johann Lavater. And the introduction was a public challenge to the German Socrates. Before the truth of God, your and my creator, I beseech you to read this work. And in case you should find the main arguments in support of the facts of Christianity, right, you should do that which Socrates doubtless would have done had he read the work and found it unanswerable. It was a call to conversion. And so I want to leave on this note this question of whether opening the doors to a philosophical enlightened society, which was Mendelssohn's goal, was a positive act when the reality of the society in which he lived was an enlightened Christian society. Right? Because you have to remember, the big shortcoming of philosophers is they often don't understand the importance of history. right? And because history is a messy, organic process. And so this is a history class, not a philosophical one, and we'll come back with the next phase of how that history plays out within the Jewish people with the Berlin Enlightenment next week. Jackie's got something to add.
Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit almad.pardes.org.